Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Good evening, everybody. I'm afraid that my German is not up to much, so this talk will be in English. I hope everybody can understand to some degree. And you can hear me at the back. My voice isn't that strong, but...
Yes.
Okay, great. I've just come back from America. I was staying in a fairly new monastery just outside Boston, in a one of the 52, is it 51 states? I can't even remember now, called New Hampshire. And it's a heavily forested area. The whole state is about 84% forest. And about 5 years ago, a tract of land, about 250 acres, was purchased and offered to establish another monastery within this tradition. So before coming here, I stopped over in England for a few days and then accepted a very generous invitation from Ajahn Abhinanda and Ajahn Kanchana to come and visit with you here. And the last time I visited was about 5 years ago, and it was a very lovely time, and it's very good to be back again. I always feel very welcomed when I come here. The community is very supportive and generous, and the lay community is also very supportive and generous, so it's always a pleasure to be at Dhammapala. Now, this new monastery that was established in the States, and all the monasteries that we or that have been generated within this tradition, but also in other traditions in Buddhism, in my understanding at least, that they just have one purpose, and that's the goal of realization for everybody who comes in contact with the monasteries. Probably most people don't realize full enlightenment, but they gain something, and it helps them along the path. They realize to some degree the nature of suffering, its causes, and they may have glimpses at cessation where the heart finds a place of peace. And faith is generated through these different levels of understanding. So we start walking along the path of practice, the path to realization. So even though these monasteries may function for other purposes also, like you know, some sort of place to gather and meet friends, a place to just to experience a sense of community, still the main goal is for realization. This is why I came to the monastery. I entered the monastery about almost 26 years ago now, 25 and a half years ago, and I'd been running a small fitness company, so I was teaching fitness to various people, and on some level it was great fun, but also it was a lot of stress, trying to make money, trying to survive in the world, having a mortgage, and just not understanding how the mind worked, not understanding what the world was all about, and through various other factors, through social factors, relationship factors, family, there was a lot of stress that I experienced. And I didn't understand how to overcome that stress or reduce it or let it all go, to allow it to cease. But one day I managed, or I inadvertently stumbled across someone who was interested in meditation, and they gave me a few tips and a tape, a guided meditation tape, and I was very fortunate that I was interested, but also the results came quite quickly. It was, I would follow the instructions on the tape, which were very, very simple, just a guided meditation, guided body sweeping meditation. And the first time I actually followed this style of practice, for the first 10 minutes I was extremely agitated and wanted to get up and move, and then suddenly my mind just slid into the body and I became peaceful for the first time that I can actually remember. I'm sure I had been peaceful before, but there was no recollection of it at that time. So through that there was insight, and there was the generation of faith. But it wasn't a Buddhist meditation. It wasn't packaged as Buddhism. It was packaged as a New Age style of meditation. Well, I followed this style for some time, and after a while I realized that there was something missing. There was a wisdom faculty within in this particular, I couldn't call it a tradition, but more like a belief system. There appeared to be a lack of wisdom. So my intuition and my own reflective capacities told me I needed to continue seeking, continuing to find or look for something that fulfilled this need for deeper understanding. So I've been meditating for about 2 years, and finally I met somebody who was a Buddhist, and he was very kind to, he was actually a counsellor, and I wasn't seeing him for that purpose, but we sat down together and we talked for about 2 hours. Mostly I just listened, and you know, almost everything he said was just made perfect sense. It was totally logical, and it also appealed to the understanding I gleaned over these 2 years of meditation. You know, it made perfect sense to me. It spoke to my heart, and intuitively I know it was correct. It was right. But what really struck me at the end of it was that the end of the conversation, I was just about to leave, and I asked him how much I owed him for that conversation for 2 hours. And he said, "You can't pay for this. It's priceless." So he wouldn't accept any money. And then he pointed me in the direction of a local monastery, and all my life, wherever I'd been, people had wanted money from me for every service that they'd offered. So it was quite startling that this was the first time that someone had done something for me, apart from maybe family, and they didn't want something in return. You know, he was just happy to offer and to help. And then I went to the monastery for the first time, and they didn't want any money either. So this gave me, you know, it helped with my faith, because they weren't They weren't trying to please me to get something in return. It was all about pointing at the truth, even if it was painful, even if it hurt, even if I didn't want to hear it. So I trusted that. I trusted that because there was no other intention. There was no other drive from these people. There was nothing they wanted from me in return. So I felt as though I could trust them. So I went on a meditation retreat at Amaravati Buddhist Monastery. This was my first introduction to Buddhism. And so I came through the gate, I went to the meditation centre, and they showed me to my bed in the dormitory. And so the 10-day retreat had started. And it was absolutely miserable. It was horrible. It was just suffering from the first minute to the last minute, because I'd just been suppressing my emotions for most of my life, just trying to get by. And suddenly the lid came off, you know, it's just all these emotions came flooding up. Anxiety, anger, frustration, guilt, shame, whatever it was, it just came flooding into consciousness, and it was very, very painful. But still, I didn't run away. I just stayed there, and I was patient with it all. And I listened as best I could to the teachings, and I started to read a few of the books. And I came across a little book called The Four Noble Truths by Lompo Samedo. And it was just, you know, it was a book that you could swallow in a mouthful. It wasn't complicated. It wasn't difficult. It wasn't difficult to understand. It was easy to understand. But it was also true. It was for me, how I saw life, how I lived my life, it was perfectly true. You know, the suffering that we all experience, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to the end of that suffering. I'd never seen anything on the spiritual level so beautifully presented and so clearly pointing at the end of what I wanted to realize, the end of suffering. I didn't have to believe in anything. It wasn't demanding that I had faith in a deity that I couldn't see or couldn't experience for myself. It was all about personal experience. You know, you could verify the Buddha's teachings right in front of you. Just by breathing in and breathing out, you could experience the suffering that it was to be a human being. And you could see how that suffering arose. You could see the causes to that suffering. And if you were wise and skillful and patient, you could see an end to it, and the happiness that that could bring. So, but at that stage, it was just an intellectual knowledge, you know. Even though I could relate those teachings to my experience previously, I didn't know what to do with those teachings. I didn't know how to bring them into my life. So, after that retreat, I felt I had to change my life. I was engaged to be married to a very beautiful and lovely young lady, and I was running this small business. As I said, I own property. You know, when I was growing up, the messages I'd received from my family and society were, you had to do certain things in the world to make you happy. And I'd fulfilled all those things on a physical level. I was independently wealthy. I had a successful business I was running. I'd found a woman that I felt very comfortable with and a lot of love for. But still, there was this suffering. So there had to be something else. There had to be something else in the world that pointed towards a place of peace and freedom. You know, the information I'd received, the conditioning I'd received, and the opportunities I'd received, they gave me some level of freedom and contentment, if you like, but I wasn't happy and I wasn't peaceful. I was stressed and I was suffering. And for many of us, this is what is a driving force for us to seek out a spiritual path. We don't start looking outside of ourselves at different things if we're totally contented and peaceful and happy all the time. A catalyst, much of the time, to actually act or seek a deeper understanding comes from discomfort, from the suffering we experience. And that's how I, this was my personal path at least. And I know from many people I've spoken to, for them it was the same. So after the retreat, I went home. My girlfriend and I were living together at the time. And towards the end of the retreat, I decided that I was going to go back to the monastery. So after 5 days at home, I packed my bags and went back and cut off the relationship. I closed the business. I sold as many possessions as I could of my own at the time. I still had a property that I couldn't obviously sell immediately. And I entered the monastery and I haven't left since. So why would someone do that? Why would someone give up a successful business, a relationship that was working, financial security, for something else, something different, that on some level had no security? There were no guarantees that enlightenment would come. It was just based on an intuition, a feeling in my gut that this was the right thing to do. If I didn't do it, I would regret it for the rest of my days. And it was just a feeling, an intuition. But over the years, the insights start to come, the understanding starts to grow, and the Four Noble Truths, they no longer remain an intellectual, very pleasant or skillful intellectual treat. They actually move from the head down into the heart, and we start to experience the reality of them. And the reality of them comes through seeing the cessation of suffering, through letting go of desire. Now, through that experience of all these years, you know, I would say that 99%, or pretty much all the Buddha's teachings, point at the present reality. You know, there's a few that you could say otherwise, but they're all trying to help us to see what's happening right now. Because ultimately speaking, that's all there is. You know, past and future don't really exist. You know, we can think about the past, and we can think about the future, but we can't actually experience past and future. So without thinking, if you drop your thinking faculties, all you experience is now. So consciousness can only function in the present, because that's all there is, the present reality. So time in and of itself is an illusion. You know, we believe that time is passing. We're getting older. You know, the planets going around the sun and the years are passing by. But in terms of our experience, if we look very closely, you know, the days and nights aren't really passing. They are passing, but they're passing through the present. Because the present doesn't go anywhere. You know, if you step off this planet, know that we can't physically do that right now, but just imagine you're in space and you're looking back at this planet from space and the sun's behind you and the planet's spinning. Now, Switzerland comes out of the darkness into the light, then it goes back into the darkness again, then it comes out into the light again. But because you're not on the planet, you don't actually experience that. You're observing the spinning planet, but days and nights are no longer a reality for you because you're not on the planet. And if you turn away from the planet and look at the sun, how do you measure time? If you don't have a watch, you're just looking at the sun, how do you measure time? We need a regularly repeating pattern to create time, like a spinning planet. You know, this spinning planet is completely different from, say, Mercury or Mars or Saturn. The days and nights on Mercury, Mars and Saturn are much longer or much shorter, and they take much longer to go around the sun. So the years are very different. The time scales are very different. So this particular time attached to this planet is particular to this planet. It's not time, it's not real time, it's planetary time or Earth time, if you like. It's not universal time. Now, we're physical Earth beings, if you like, but we're also universal creatures. Our consciousness can experience the universe. And our consciousness functions in a certain way. It always is in the present, and it experiences objects. So Ajahn Chah would say, "Jit ben jit, arom ben arom, ko mai mangan," which means consciousness is consciousness, and the objects of consciousness are the objects of consciousness. They're not the same thing. So by this he means consciousness is one thing and the objects are different. Consciousness stays still and the objects of consciousness are passing through consciousness. So sights, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations, thoughts and emotions are passing through consciousness and consciousness remains where it is. Now we suffer because we grasp hold of the objects of consciousness. We grasp hold of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations, thoughts and emotions. And that's when we suffer. We want them or we don't want them. We grasp hold of them. So a spinning planet is sight. Days and nights is seeing. It's an object of consciousness. It's not real, ultimately speaking. It's just a passing, something that's passing through consciousness. Same as sounds, smells, tastes, sensations, thoughts, emotions. Thoughts and emotions are not who and what we are. They're just objects of consciousness. So can your thinking know consciousness? Can your sensations know consciousness? Can your emotions know consciousness? No, they can't. But consciousness knows thinking. It knows emotions. It knows sensations. Because consciousness is that which is really real. Without consciousness, there is nothing, absolutely nothing. But most people in the world are totally obsessed with the objects of consciousness. They don't even notice consciousness. But consciousness is the most obvious thing there is. There is nothing other than consciousness, ultimately speaking. As you bring it back, you bring it back. Even the objects are just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. The objects are even just that much. So, Lompo Samedo, Ajahn Chah, the Buddha, he says consciousness is our refuge. It's the place of peace. You don't have to look for it because you are it. You don't have to seek it out because it's that which is already here. And ultimately speaking, the path that we're treading, we're walking, it's not really a path, ultimately. It's more like a tornado. So a tornado is like a big storm that spins round, yeah? Round and round and round. And in the centre of that tornado is a place of peace. It's a place of stillness. And everything that's whipping round is, if we use a metaphor, it's like the world. Or it's like the objects of consciousness. So when we grasp an object of consciousness, we just get whipped round like the storm and we start to suffer. So when we grasp something, we want something that's outside of ourselves, we grasp and then we get caught up. When we're not grasping anything at all, we let go into the centre. And that centre's always here, always now, because that's all there is. There isn't anything else. There'll never be anything else. Even your body aging is an object of consciousness. It's passing through. You know, consciousness doesn't get born and doesn't die. The body gets born and dies. Thoughts get born and die. Emotions get born and die. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes. Sensations get born and die. But according to the great teachers, you know, pure consciousness doesn't. They call it Jit Dharm Ter in Thai, or Vijnana Tat, which means the consciousness element, the element of consciousness. So when we truly let go of suffering, it's like we just come into this place of peace automatically. So when we're always trying, in our practice, trying to get somewhere, so like we've got a meditation object, like the breath, and we're pumping away on the breath, trying to, you know, get concentrated, because we don't feel as though we're good enough as we are, or the situation isn't right, there's something unpleasant, we've got an unpleasant emotion in the present, we're trying to get away from it. Everything is becoming more tense because we're grasping hold of the objects of consciousness, the tornado. We're grasping hold of that part that's outside of ourselves. And we start to suffer. So when we're sitting in meditation, if we're resisting anything in the present, we're creating tension in the present. If we're wanting to get a better present in the future, you know, if we believe time is real, all we're doing is creating tension in ourselves, right here, right now. So one great Zen master, he said, when we truly, deeply, profoundly understand timelessness, when we truly, deeply, profoundly understand timelessness, total acceptance is the only option. So timelessness, when the Buddha points to this, akaliko in the scriptures, It's not that things are timeless through time. He's saying that timelessness, this is it. This is where consciousness is. This is our home. So it's not trying to get rid of what we've got right now. It's making peace with it. We're making peace with the present rather than trying to get rid of it or change it. We're embracing it. We're bringing it in. We're accepting it. We're making friends with it. Because the more we try and reject it or force it to be something that other than it is, we just create tension, we create suffering for ourselves. So the Buddha points to this in the Four Noble Truths. It's not about getting, you know, brilliant mind states through meditation. It's about letting go of desire. To get rid of, and to become. This is the way to peace. And if we look at the Four Noble Truths, so if we look at the Eightfold Path, the last section of the Four Noble Truths, the first aspect of that path is right understanding. And that is right understanding around the Four Noble Truths, or the first three, in fact. So when we truly understand the first three Noble Truths, we've got right understanding. And our understanding is what informs our intention. So our intention informs our effort, our mindfulness, and our meditation. So if we've got wrong understanding, our meditation is going to be wrong. If we've got wrong understanding, our intention is going to be wrong, our effort is going to be wrong, our mindfulness is going to be wrong, and our meditation is going to be wrong. So we're going to be lost and we're going to suffer. But if we understand the Four Noble Truths, so we take that intellectual understanding from our heads into our hearts, then our understanding will be correct. And all our effort from that understanding, our intention from that understanding, will be perfect. Therefore, our effort will be perfect, our mindfulness will be perfect, and our meditation will be perfect, and we will experience perfect peace. So in the world, we see everything as linear. This leads to this, to this, to this, to this. And then we get this. Now, if we do that in our practice, it's miles away from reality. Reality is there's just this. There's nothing other than this. And all our experiences in the world, in our family, our jobs, it's all just sight, sound, smells, tastes, tactile impressions, mental activity, passing through consciousness. Ultimately speaking, that's all it really is. It doesn't mean we don't pay attention to these things. We have responsibilities in the world. We do need to learn from our mistakes. So we do use memory. We do learn from those things, and we plan for the future. But that's conventional reality, and we know it as such. We don't mix up conventional reality with ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is this state of timelessness, this state of pure experience, pure knowing. And when we truly let go of our efforts to get somewhere else, we automatically become fully present. All the effort to get somewhere actually takes part of us out of the present. It creates a fracture or a breaking up of the mind. It's not as though, ultimately all we can ever be is present. It's impossible not to be present. But because we get lost in our own world, there's a fracture in consciousness. So you know what happens here. The mind is all over the place, basically. We're thinking about this, thinking about this. We're worried about this. And we get caught up in all sorts of emotions and desires. And we don't know whether we're coming or going. We get very confused. That's called a fractured mind. Whereas when we become fully conscious or fully aware, it's like it's oneness, this state of pure knowing. And the experience of me being in here and the world outside fades away. There's no sense of separation. So you become fully conscious, whole if you like, complete. So you're just letting go. And when you let go, that's automatically what happens. You don't have to make yourself mindful. You are mindful. It's not something you can force. It's an act of trust. It's a gift. You just give yourself to the present. And it's incredibly simple. But we're incredibly complicated. So ultimately we make it complicated again because we can't help ourselves. I think that's enough for this evening.
Kandamayam Dhammakathaya Sadhukaram Dadamase
Sadhukaram.